Well, good morning. They say it's good when you don't have any preparation for these things, but my name's Rich and I'm an alcoholic. I am a retread. My sobriety date is November 2nd, 2020 or 2021. I'm coming up on 3 years in November. I have a sponsor. My sponsor is Brian Barry. I talk to him every day at minimum a text. Generally, a conversation. We are a pretty strong partnership in this program, meaning that we work together. He's not my guru. He's not my thesaurus. He's not my go-to. He's not my spiritual advisor. He's my friend with a level of sobriety that I really aspire to get. I have a home group. I belong to the North Evans Men's Discussion Group. We meet on Saturday mornings at 9:30 in the morning. I am of service there this month. I'm chairing the meetings. Last month, I was coffee. The month before that, I was a greeter. I'm sitting here at first and foremost. I've seen Bud when he first came in. I watched Bud go out and I watched Bud come back a different person. And this time around, he's been claws dug in, doing what he's supposed to do. And I got to be honest, I've had Bud to my house. I consider Bud a friend. So I really appreciate the fact that you think highly enough of me to refer me to do something like this for your home group. I have Josh new to this meeting as a friend of mine. Oh, you're going to be speaking? Send me the info. I'll show right up. I got to call this out. I'm looking up in the top corner and I see Mike B from Buffalo. I want to say that I went to elementary school with Mike B. His father was my jazz ensemble teacher. He was the one teacher at my high school that I didn't want to set on fire. I know Mike's sister. I know Mike's mother. How freaking crazy is it to show up in a room like this on a Sunday morning, and here we are. I mean,
Love it.
here I thought I was the only super screwed up one at Sweet Home High. I mean, where to begin? I first came into this program in 1999. I stayed until 2002. I followed a different path thinking I could do things different. I was older, my life was different. I went back out. I stayed out until like 2018. And then I spent a few years dry. And then, due to circumstances in my life, I ended up back in this program. So, how did it all begin? I mean, I grew up with an alcoholic mom. She's still to this day an alcoholic. I love her for it. I've tried to fix her, I've tried to pull her in here. She weighs 102 pounds. I weigh 263. I can't pull her in. I got nothing to do with that. It's out of my control. So I have to pray about it and I have to just love her for the woman that she is. You know, she provided me with the childhood that was the best that she could. My parents got divorced at a very young age. At 7 years old, my father was in a terrible truck accident, passed away. To give you a little idea of how my life looked at that time, my parents were divorced. The boyfriend that my mom had, as you might guess, you know, alcoholics don't exactly source super healthy people. We got the news that my dad had passed away. My mom and I were both hysterical, and her boyfriend beat both of us up because we shouldn't have cared. Because basically, F him. That was the mode I got out of the day. So from an early childhood, all I knew was no matter what happened, I was afraid. I was afraid I wouldn't have a dad around. I was afraid my mom's boyfriends would be violent. I was afraid my mom would be drunk and make an ass of me and our friends. I was afraid of everything. I was afraid of the shadows in the corner. I was afraid of the closet. I was afraid of everything under the bed. I was a petite kid. After a little while, we were living in Ohio. My mom moved back to Buffalo because she had family here. So that was like the sensible thing to do because she at least had a little bit of help. And that's where really my journey starts here. I lived in Amherst, New York. We grew up in Looney Acres. I remember having a pretty cool childhood. I mean, looking back at it, it's nothing I would want for my kid. But I almost there are times where, if I'm going to be honest, I feel a little sad for our children that they didn't grow up the way we did. And I get it's different times. God, we had so much fun. But then I look back, I think the first time I took an actual drink to get drunk, I don't think I was much more than 10 years old. Me and some kids at the one marina we were at snuck some beers, went down to the dock, got hammered. And all the adults at the marina thought it was cute. Nobody got in trouble, nothing bad happened. Oh, look at these cute little kids doing their thing. So, needless to say, I learned something that first time. I learned that hangovers were a bitch, and I learned that I was going to drink again, and I was going to do it as often as I could. I moved on, got into school. I never really fit in anywhere, so I thought. I just went to my 30-year class reunion, and I realized that a lot of the delusion that I had at school for all the people that I thought didn't like me and we didn't get along, 30 years later, that was all bullshit. Like, I had more good conversations with people that I thought hated me in school. And then I realized that my view on life from a very young age was just deluded, that I had to question everything from my childhood and how I felt and how I saw things. Because I look back and I realized that I was definitely seeing them through a kaleidoscope. I wasn't seeing them through a clear lens. So school was good, you know. I mean, I didn't really fit in anywhere, but I kind of was that chameleon where I fit in with a little bit with everybody. We went in the woods and drank a lot. We snuck beers out of garages and drank a lot. My buddy Darren Wagner, we used to go to his neighborhood. He lived in like the nice ritzy neighborhood, so we could just sneak into the garages because this is before house alarms had even been invented, really. And we get like one or two beers from each garage, so nobody would know. We go back in the woods and get hammered, and you know, no. Nothing really ever bad happened from that, but I mean, we got drunk, we got hungover. That was bad. I remember waking up one day. I was about 16 years old. I wasn't doing great in school. I was in 10th grade. I had failed a grade earlier on, had to repeat it. And I just told my mom, I said, "Listen, I'm not doing this anymore." She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "School. I'm over it." She said, "No, you got to go to school." I said, "No, I'm not going to go." She's like, "Well, today?" And I'm like, "No, ever." And due to living with an alcoholic mom who, looking back, was literally trying to make up for all the wrongs that she'd ever done in the worst possible ways, it flew. Like, I'm sure it wasn't as easy as I remember it, but I was like, yeah, I'm just not going back to school. I'm dropping out. I'm going to go work. I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to go be productive. And that's really all I learned from my mom, was how to work hard, because she was the hardest worker I've ever met. So my stepdad luckily owned a business. He owned a property management company. This man is a saint. He's in my life to this day. He's struggling with cancer. He's getting a military commendation next weekend. I was scheduled to be on a treatment and corrections panel at the convention, and I had to bow out of that so that I could go down to Raleigh to be with my dad for the weekend to get this award. So I don't know how much longer he's going to make it, but he had this property management company, managed all these rentals in Buffalo. And if you ever seen the old like 80s and 90s rentals in Buffalo, all the basements were filled with stone. I bet you I single-handedly by myself, all alone, with a shovel and a 5 gallon bucket, emptied 25 of those basements. Put the dirt and stone out in the backyard, not because he needed it done, because he was mad at me and he wanted me to suffer. And being the good alcoholic that I was, all it really did was put money in my pocket, which at 16 years old, I was in Niagara Falls. I was at Club Exit. And then at 17, 18, I was at the Pleasure Dome, having my 70 Chevelle valet parked right in front of the door as I rolled in underage to drink pitchers of Long Island teas until I blacked out in Niagara Falls and drove all the way home to Niagara Falls Boulevard, Tonawanda Creek Road. Don't remember a single mile of the ride. Managed to get home in a 70 Chevelle with an LS6 454 in it and a stick. Got it in the garage, didn't smash it up. The next morning, I would come out and, oh God, please. Nope, didn't crash the car last year. Good. I mean, that's what I turned into. And somehow, some way in there, my dad was a Marine. His best friend, my Uncle Ned, is a retired Marine. Ned's mom and dad were both retired Marines, career Marines. About 18 years old, I decided, you know what? I think I'm going to join the military. I'm sick of Buffalo. I could at least realize that I was in a funnel. I was like literally in a toilet, and every time somebody walked by, they just kept flushing it, and I just kept swimming for my life just to not go down the drain. So I go in and I say, you know what? I see the recruiters. I go in. I was kind of a frumpy kid. I had to do a bunch of physical stuff to get up to bare minimums. I had to eat this tomato and something diet for like 2 weeks to make way in to even go. I was not a great Marine candidate at this time. I was an alcoholic teenager. I had played sports, but that had been a long time ago. So nonetheless, I go down to the recruiters and they're like, "Well, listen, you know, I have a high school diploma. You can't join the Marine Corps. I mean, like, even we have standards." And I'm like, "Damn." I'm like, "All right." So I go back to my alma mater. I walk into Sweet Home High School and I go in and I say, okay, listen, I need to talk to somebody about getting GED. I really screwed up. I mean, I went in licking my wounds pretty good, and it was the truth. Looking back, it's one of the biggest mistakes of my life. Only because I know how easy school really is compared to real life. I wish I would have stayed and just gutted it out. But I'm an alcoholic, and the path I'm on is I have to take the longest path around the block every single time. Even to this day, I seem to like to take the hard way. So I go in, they get me signed up for this class. I go in, they say, okay, here's your card. Come back in like 8 weeks. We're going to get you in. And this is where you're going to take the test. But we'll see you tomorrow because we do a review study class. So we'll go over the whole test. We got books, take practice tests, and we'll get you to the point where you're definitely going to pass. And just being an egotistical maniac, I took my card. I was like, F you, I don't need this. This is bullshit. This class is for retards. And I walked out and I went and I took my test. And out of a possible 235 points, I scored 233. Walked back to Sweet Home High School. I went to Mr. Sparrow. Said, hey, remember the kid who was never going to be anything? I just scored higher than anybody ever scored on this GED test from your high school, pound salt. I'll see you when I get back from the Marine. And I left. And this was a teacher, this is our disciplinary principal, who told me I was going to be a loser. He probably wasn't calling it real wrong based on the facts in front of him. He knew I was a drinker. He knew I was a partier. He knew I was dropping out of school. He knew I was going to be in trouble. So off I go to the Marine Corps. And this is the first time in my life that I've ever really committed to anything. I mean, I played high school sports where you got to sign contracts and say you won't do this. That's not commitment. Commitment signing a contract where you become property of the government. And if they want to beat you to death, they pretty much can. So off I went. Here I stand on the yellow footprints. It was the most traumatizing thing that had ever happened to me because for the first time in my life, I didn't have my mom around trying to fix everything for whatever she was capable. I was on my own. And it was the first time in my life where on my own and left to my own devices, I excelled. I don't know what it was about the Marine Corps. It was just, it fit me. It was what I needed because I was this terrified, anxious, worried, perpetually scared of the world kid. And when I went in there at 230 some pounds, kind of soft, I mean, definitely not, I don't look like I look today. And I came out of there at 177, 178 pounds. When I went home on boot leave, I was a different human being. I was not the same kid who left. I was, however, still an alcoholic. That didn't go away. I still like to drink. And I'll be honest with you, if you ever wanted to hide yourself from being an alcoholic, the absolute best enclosure to go to would be the Marine. And I don't think it's probably that way so much anymore. But back when I was around, they didn't care how much you drank, they didn't care when you drank. As long as you could do your job successfully and safely, because you could drink till 4 in the morning, show up for PT at 5:30, and as long as you go out there and get good scores, they didn't really care. I used to go out there and run 3 miles in 18 minutes, do 20 dead hang pull-ups, and do like 100 sit-ups in 2 minutes, and I would do it piss drunk, not hungover, like literally 40 minutes away from my last shot of whiskey drunk. They didn't care. That's a perfect PFT in the Marine Corps. If you could do that, you're a stud. But they would crack jokes and tell me how I should probably see how good you could be if you weren't drunk. So, needless to say, I spent some time in the Marine Corps. I was pretty successful there. My drinking accelerated because it could. There was very little control. We went to Thailand on an exercise. We were the pre-setup group. We had a 30 days to set everything up. We set everything up in 6 days, and we had like 3 weeks of unrestricted drinking in Thailand. It's just operations like that, opportunities like that for an alcoholic. It was just everywhere. Like, and it was just accepted that I don't know that anybody drank any differently than I did in there. I keep in touch with some of my friends that I was in there with, and they're not alcoholics, but they drank like I did. Like when we were there, they drank that way, but apparently they aren't afflicted with this disease. So, needless to say, I volunteered for everything that I could do to put me in harm's way in the Marine Corps. I ended up into a reconnaissance Marine or a reconnaissance platoon over in Japan because I had some connections in my battalion that I was with. My officer hated where I was. He was a Mustang. He was a Fulbright colonel now, but he was a sergeant in Force Recon in Vietnam. So he pulled some strings with the general in my building and got me sent down to 5th Force Recon, where I did some really cool training. Really double down on falling in love with the Marine Corps. Like, hey, what are you guys doing? Nothing. Hey, tonight at 2100, I need you in the hangar bay. Okay, we show up. They hand you some water gear. They fly you 2.5 miles off the coast of Okinawa in a helicopter. Lights go green. You jump. You got to swim back to shore. Figure out where you are on the map. This is where we dropped you. This is where you got to go. You got a map and a compass board and 7 or 8 guys that you're swimming with, and you got to get back. And we managed to move the get back point a little bit out there 2.5 miles away, so that where we landed on Okinawa was right the beach, right by the E Club. So we went out of the water up to the enlisted club, and we started drinking, and we stayed there till like 5:30 in the morning. Showed back up at our squad bay. Everybody's waiting, like, what took you so long? Like, we were right on time. Listen, we marked where we hit land. Then we went to the E Club and had some drinks. Oh, it was acceptable. Like, they didn't care. Like, normally you get fired at a job for not doing your job. So I got hurt in a mountaineering course. I fell about 45 feet off a sheer rock face, shattered all the bones in my left foot. And it really had a negative effect on my performance for a lot of what I was doing in the Marine Corps. So they offered me a desk job or a med board. I did not want a desk job in the Marine Corps. That's not why I joined. I wanted to go do cool things, which I was. So I was posed with a real dilemma. I wasn't a decision maker, obviously. So I, looking back, I should have took a desk job, could have kept that career. I fit in. It would have been easy. I could have been retired from there by now. But I decided to come home, and I come back to Buffalo, New York. So I move home. I take on a couple jobs. I am moving back with my parents for a little bit until I got an apartment, which was fine. And then I go into the bar this one night, Chasers in the Barcade on Niagara Falls Boulevard, the old Mannequins, the old Free Calls. So I go in there with a couple buddies. We go up the stairs, and you get to the top. And up at the top of the stairs, there's these 2.5 rowdy guys, like two normal sized guys, and maybe a guy that was just a little bigger than a midget, but not much, beating up like four of the bouncers up on the landing. So I'm like, what is going on here? So I'm like, all right. I go in there. I take those two guys. I pummel them quick. I drag all 2.5 of them down the stairs. I get them arrested. I go back upstairs. A week later, I'm running security at said bar. Not a good place for me to be. Now I have free access to all I want to drink. I have power. I have authority. A couple weeks later, they had me and the general manager, who was friends with the owner, co-general managing so that I could babysit him. And this is about how my MO went. I caught the guy at the door on Wednesday night. It was 10 bucks all you could drink. We'd bring in about, I don't know, like we bring in about 5 grand a night. What we found out was he was stealing a couple $1,000 a night from the cup. So for ease of math, we'll say we're bringing in 7, he was turning in 5. So I go to the owner of the club and I say, listen, I got this great thing. I just caught this guy stealing. I fired him. I'm going to take over the door. This guy was stealing $1,000 every Wednesday from me. So now I can take $1,000 every Wednesday. I'm giving him a grand more. And in my head, this is, I did him a favor. He should be grateful for me. And that's where my thought process went. Things took a really dark turn. I know this isn't about drugs. Drugs are a little bit of my story. And it's really the thought process less than the product. But me and a couple of guys were working at this other club, and the one guy said we should do ecstasy. So we all said yes. We had a blast, and it was expensive. So being the alcoholic that I am, and not being an idiot, which most of us are not, the next week I go to the guy he bought it from, my friend. I go to that guy. I said, "Who'd you get it from? I need to talk to him." And I go to that guy. I said, "Who'd you get it from? I need to talk to him." Well, I can't tell you that. If you don't tell me that, I'm going to break your arm. Oh, I get it from him. Give me his number. I call him. I go set up a deal. And that week I bought 100. I sold 90. We kept 10. Life was good. And that's who I am as an alcoholic. I make bad choices. I make choices based on violence. I use violence in my life like it was a spoon eating soup. And the next thing I know, the DEA is kicking my door in because Randy Fry, the head of the DEA, in federal court, he told the federal judge, although they couldn't prove it, the term he used was metric tons of cocaine were what this man has trafficked through our communities. hundreds of thousands of pills of ecstasy through our community. And he was probably a little high on the cocaine, and he was way low on the ecstasy. And that's where I ended up. I ended up, my entire life came crashing down on my head. I'm looking around, I got nothing. I had this great apartment, like every profitable drug dealer that you ever could imagine, and all this cool stuff. It was all gone. Everybody in my life that could get away, like rats going off a sinking ship, had swum away. I was living with the most degenerate human being I knew, but he was the only one that would take me in at the time. So I woke up one day, and after a little bit of work, and I had stockpiled myself a supply, I downed about 300 sleeping pills with two bottles of Jack Daniels. I figured I'm just going to go to bed and the world would be a better place without me. It was not my, that was not my, wasn't what I was supposed to do, according to my higher power. I talked to a doctor friend of mine, said that should have killed me a couple of times. It was a 3-day hallucinative blackout nightmare that I got to be honest, I could write a book about it because I almost remember every minute of it. I called the Amherst police department because I thought demons were coming out of the couch. It was a nightmare. It was like being in hell. If I could give you any account, not that I know what hell looks like, but if I could give you an account of how I felt, it felt like I was in hell. And I really worried that it was going to be like that forever. So when that storm subsided, this most degenerate person on the planet told me, hey, listen, I love you. You got to go. You can't stay here anymore. I mean, I called the cops to his house. He was a drug addict. So I'm standing on West Somerset in front of an apartment, standing on the sidewalk, and I'm trying to think of how I can get a ride up to the 290. Because if chemicals can't kill me, stepping in front of a tractor trailer at speed, it's got to do it. And that has to work. And I got this inclination, and I know exactly where it came from today. At the time, I was baffled. I called an old friend that I hadn't seen in quite some time. And his first statement was, where are you? What's the address? I'm coming to get you. And a friend of mine came and picked me up, and he took me to his house. He gave me a little bit of money to go get lunch. He lived down in the city of Buffalo on Richmond Avenue in a really big, old, cool mansion. And the insanity really ensued there. Because at that point, I didn't have any money, so he got me a job bouncing. So I would go and bounce, and I would drink, but it wasn't really out of control because I was, I don't know, terrified, scared, shell-shocked from everything that had happened. And then it got to a point where I would go out on a Sunday night to Kohl's, and I would have a couple beers, and I'd have to go, and I knew I had to go to Rise Bell services on Monday morning. And somehow, some way, I would drink a couple beers, and I'd end up blowing lines of cocaine on the bar. And I'd fail a drug test. And how to this day, I'm on federal pretrial services. I'm going to prison for trafficking narcotics. I don't know how I never got violated. I think they were just overwhelmed and they didn't want me in the system. But I think 4 or 5 weeks in a row, having drug tests on Monday or Tuesday, I find myself at a bar on Sunday drinking and doing drugs. And I got to a point where I went down to my probation officer. I said, listen, at the time it was the HSBC Tower. I said, you can't get me into a rehab. I'm like, I'm 5 weeks in. I can't not drink. I can't not do drugs. Even when I got a drug test, I know I'm going to fail. I said, I don't know what's wrong, but I'm at my road set. I'm like, I'm going up to the top of HSBC Tower and I'm jumping off. I'm like, that's where I'm at. Tallest building in Buffalo. That is where I'm at. I need to get in somewhere. Well, there's no beds. I don't want to fucking hear it. Sorry about my life. I don't want to hear it. These are your two options. You're either going to have me off your ledger or you're going to have me off your ledger. You pick the way you want. If you want to scrape me up, don't do anything. He literally called me that night at like 9 o'clock, which is weird. Says, hey, be at Horizon Village tomorrow at like 8:30 in the morning. I got you a bed. And that started me on a different trajectory. My buddy drove me out there. I walked in those front doors. And when I walked in, I was like a scared rabbit. And all I wanted was some hope that I didn't have to keep living this way. Because I'd spent my entire adult life, my childhood, my adult life, getting me to this point where I was just belligerently hopeless. Like, I'm like, I can't do this. I don't know how to live. I don't know how to function in the world. I'm like, I'm just a blight on society. The world would be better off without me. And what they introduced me to, which really, if I'm going to boil it down, I can't say the counseling was bad. I don't remember much of being there, but they took me to AA meetings. And then the biggest advantage I got out of there is they got me into a supportive living house. They got me into an Oxford house at the corner of Longmeadow and Delwood. And because I got into that house in 1999 is when I ended up there. I would walk up to Main Street in Amherst, and it's the holy grail of meetings. I mean, you can catch a bus 5 minutes in either direction. You go up to Cleveland Drive. All of you guys know, this is your neighborhood. There's a million meetings there. And I went to all of them because they told me if I went to meetings that I wouldn't drink anymore, that I could find a way to not have to drink on a daily basis. And for the first time in my life, I was hopeless. So I went in there and I met some of the best friends that I've met. I actually, Mike H was at a speaker meeting this time when I came back. I came in about 6 months after he came in. My sponsor, one of the first meetings I go to on Main Street was, if you guys know Ned H and Sue H, Ned H was my sponsor. He was my Uncle Ned. I walked in the front door. He came over and gave me the biggest hug I'd ever gotten from him and said, I knew you'd be here sooner or later. And I walked in and I did everything that I was supposed to do. And I've actually since taken my break in the wild, like coming back, I've been in touch with Ned quite a bit. And I called him the other day and I asked him, I said, did I have good sobriety or did I screw something up? And I did everything right. I got into the book. I got into working the steps. I didn't do any real service. Looking back, I mean, if I'm being honest, I went to meetings and I got into that book and I worked the steps and I was honest and I was rigorously honest and we killed it and it helped. And he told me I did a good job. Like I did a good job in sobriety and that I shouldn't have had any issues. And then the reality is I got about 3 years, 3.5 years sober, and I went and stood in front of a federal judge. I got sentenced to 2 years in prison. I went, I did that. I came home. I started a meeting while I was there. There was nobody doing anything there. I went into a room every like Tuesday afternoon and read my big book. And if anybody came in, I would tell them what I was doing. The one guard was pretty cool with it. I think he was probably in the program. One day he comes in with six big books. He's like, hey, in case anybody else wants to come in. So now I put a sign on the door. Hey, Amy, come on in. And by the time I left, there was probably 4 to 8 guys every couple of days that would go in there. And we would do 2 meetings a week. We'd do a discussion and we'd do a big one. When I left, they were still doing it as far as I know. I came home. I went through the trials and tribulations of getting out of federal prison. And I went right back to that supportive living house. Because that was the first place in the real world where I was responsible for myself and I was able to function. And I came back and I hit the meetings. Things went well. I got a job. I started making real money. I bought a car. I got into a relationship. It didn't go terrible. It didn't work out, but it wasn't a terrible relationship. It never got nasty. It never got ugly. It just dissolved kind of on its own. And then I met this girl and I started chasing her around, and I would tell you that it was a giant mistake, but she's downstairs in my kitchen as we speak. So it worked out in the end, but man, was it an effed up ride. So we start hanging out and she's from Angola. I'm from Amherst. I didn't know people live at this far south in Angola. I thought this was a different state. So I'm literally running all over creation. I'm coming out here, spending the night. I'm driving to Lockport on my motorcycle, let my dog out in the morning. Going to freewheeling cycle at Tonawanda in the afternoon, working 12 hours, back to Lockport to play with my dog for a minute, and then get back on my bike and I ride as fast as humanly possible out to Angola so I can hang out with my girlfriend. And I did this 7 days a week. It was pretty hairy. It was pretty crazy. But as you can imagine, there was no time for AA, nor did I make time. So I stopped going to meetings. I relocated. I didn't find new AA people. And lo and behold, I was at a wedding in Boston and we had a conversation and, oh, you can probably drink. It'll be fine. And had a couple of vodka cranberries, and, you know, nothing happened. I didn't explode. DEA didn't kick in the door of the wedding. Nothing bad happened. Just so I can mention, when I tried to off myself the first time, all the worldly possessions I have fill a backpack like this about halfway up. So now I got a girlfriend. We get married. I'm drinking. I drink for about 15 years. We have a baby. We buy her grandfather's house on Lake Erie. I live right at the beach. We remodel that house. We go on vacations. We got four or five cars. We got motorcycles. We got snowmobiles. We got jet skis. We got a boat. I got money. And I find myself sitting downstairs in the house that I'm in right now, looking out the door at the water. I'm all high and drunk and thinking about how I could kill myself and make it look like an accident. Because now I got a 9-year-old daughter up in bed and I can't do that. So I thought it was because I was broke and I had nothing and my life had crumbled and that's why I wanted to kill myself. But what's my excuse now? Now I have checked every worldly box for the stuff. And I find myself in the exact same mindset that made me want to off myself. And I wish I could say that was like the last moment. I ended up at 44 years old getting a DWI. That was a great time. It worked out as good as it could possibly work out. I suppose I deserved it. I've been unconvicted of probably 500, 1,000, 2,000 DWIs. And that spawned, that really messed me up though. It put me into a funk. I knew too much about not drinking and how bad it was for me. And now it's the whole, oh, it's going to get worse. Well, it's getting worse. And I had to look at that. And the one night, my last night of drinking, my unofficial last night of drinking, I was downstairs. I don't know why we'd been out drinking where we were, but I was belligerently drunk. And at the time, my 10-year-old daughter said something along the lines of, "Dad, if you're going to go to bed, you should brush your teeth." And the way I exploded on her, I didn't physically touch her, but the way I exploded on her turned me into everything that I feared, hated, and despised about my life. And it was everything that I promised I would never become, and I had become it in a far greater fashion. I took it to a level that my mom's degenerate boyfriends never could. I was by far a more evil, insidious being than they ever could have been, and I've never felt guilt, shame, and remorse like I did after that. It took 3 days for the hangover to go away. I took her out to lunch, and I promised her on that day that she would never see that version of me again. And to this day, it's been true. That was like October 31st, 2018. It wasn't my last day of drinking. That was the day that I quit drinking. I was in Miami with I don't know, Mike, you might remember Larry Bergen. He's my daughter's godfather. So we were on vacation in Miami. Oh, she's not even here. Let's have some drinks. So we had some Captain and Diets at Ruth's Steakhouse. We had some drinks in the hotel room. I didn't get drunk. I didn't get rowdy. Begin to fight and throw anybody off the balcony. I didn't get arrested. All I did the next day, I was like, what in the F? This was November 1st, 2021. And I'm like, what did I just do? I'm like, I actually had a little bit of time away from the drink and now I just hit the red reset button. So now my sobriety date is November 2nd, 2021. And I don't really care what the date is because the reality is I could screw this thing up this afternoon and drink tomorrow. I have today. But where do we go from there? So we're on this vacation. We have some drinks. Try to move forward a little bit here so we don't run out of time. Flash forward a number of years. There's some marital trouble now. Now I'm not drinking. My wife is a heavy drinker, so I believe. When I first met her, I thought she'd outgrow it. And it turns out to be she's one of us. And this was the weirdest thing in the world, because up until 10 months ago, I had no idea what the problem was. I knew there was a problem. So for about 11 years, I wasn't drinking. I was drinking a little, then I quit drinking. And our marriage at that point was we would go to bars, we would go to here. And I knew enough where I begged God to remove the obsession for me to drink. I don't know how, I don't know why, I don't know what the key is to him doing that, but before we came back into the program, which again, and I haven't been back in the program terribly long. It's been almost a year. But like last summer, we were at the Buffalo Bills boat parade. And I'm handing trays of shots from boat to boat to boat. And I literally never once was like, oh, I should take one of these. I mean, if anything, I joked with my buddy Ed, who knows my situation. I'm like, hey, how mad would they be if I dropped one of these into the river? And he's like, dude, don't do it. Don't do it. But I could literally, I'm telling you now, I could go and I could bartend. I have no desire to drink. None at all. I have enough of a reset circuit that's gone on in my head I know to look forward to what it would cause. One time I played Call of Duty, I go down to the basement. It's a number of years ago. I'm not drinking. I'm not in the program, but somebody had put Captain Morgan on my fridge downstairs. We live at the beach. People leave stuff here all the time. They used to. And I grabbed my six pack of Diet Pepsi and I'm like, oh man, I should make a diet and Captain. And I'm like, okay, think. And I'm standing there talking to myself out loud at like midnight now in my basement. I said, all right, think about it. You're going to drink enough out of that Diet Pepsi to pour four shots in there. And then let's be honest, if you're going to make one, you may as well make all six because one's not going to do any good. So now we're going to drink 24 shots. And I'm not sure there's even that many shots left in this bottle. And I literally pumped the brakes right there. And I'm going to, pardon my language, I'm like, Rich, you are a fucked up individual. Take your pop and go play games with your friends. And that's exactly what I did. I thought it through, how stupid it would be, how bad it would roll in my life. And I moved on. So I'm suffering some pretty significant marriage problems. It's obviously a non-alcoholic living with an alcoholic. There's no legitimate communication between the two of us. There's no emotional sobriety in my house at all. There's nothing but tension and vibration, conflict. And that was how we lived for a lot of years. And it wasn't good. Last November, we were out of town and our marriage came to an end while we were down in Charlotte. The general synopsis of it was, my wife's behavior had finally, after 10 years, become more painful for me to tolerate than it would be of the pain of me leaving. And I was willing to leave my beach house. I was walking away with nothing. I didn't care. I'm entitled to part of her retirement. I didn't want none of that. All I wanted was to get away. Like, I needed to be free because it was just poisoning me. And I didn't know exactly how or why, but it was. So our marriage pretty much grenaded. The biggest fear of my child was, Dad, you're not going to leave me with her, are you? To which the answer was no. I mean, this separation was going to be biblically bad. It was going to be catastrophically bad for her, which, through all of the turmoil, there's never a 5-minute window, not a 5-second window where I haven't loved this woman to the pit of my core. But I wasn't in love with her, but I loved her. Like, I didn't want to leave because the look on her face was going to just absolutely destroy me. So we get home. We had to fly home, talk about the most uncomfortable flight in the history of manned flight. Her mom picks us up at the airport. We get in the car. You could have heard a pin drop in this car. Like, her mom was even like, that was the most uncomfortable car ride I've ever had. We get home. I was in Charlotte. I had made a phone call. I had an apartment being made. My buddy didn't have any 2 bedrooms, but he's like, I can knock a wall out if you really want me to. This was Sunday when I made the call. Monday, the walls were all knocked out of that apartment to make it a 2-bedroom. I was leaving. I was done. I had made my decision. I didn't pray about it. I didn't do any of that. I wasn't back in the program yet. I didn't have any tools. But I was done. I was leaving. I was going to pack my shit and I was going to move on. It was going to take nothing. And I was just going to go start over. I had thought about going back to AA because I knew that I needed something. And this has been the only thing in my life that's ever given me a semblance of peace or happiness. So she comes into me the first day we're home. We get home on a Monday. It's a holiday. Tuesday, we ended up having snow. She works for the school district, so she got another day off. She comes into me on Monday morning, and she's like, listen, I need to show you something. I'm like, at this point, I don't care. Like, if your hair is on fire, I don't want to see. I just don't care. I'm not going to help. I'm done. If the house is on fire, fine. Get the kid outside. I'll just stay here, whatever. I didn't care. I was broke. And she goes into her walk-in closet. She starts pulling bottles of alcohol, bottles of Tito's. And instantly, I'm like, holy cow, I know what this is. This starts to make a little sense. I didn't care, but okay, I'll get rid of that for you. So we have a very uncomfortable day that day. The next day is a school day. She's got to go to work, but then we get a snow day, so she's off. She comes into my office in the morning. She's like, I need to show you something. I'm like, all right, what now? Like, what could you possibly want to show me? And she shows me a credit card she's had forever. And it's got all these charges on it where she was buying alcohol where I wouldn't see or know. And I'm like, wow. I'm like, why don't, like, at the time, I didn't care. Whatever. Great. Thanks for your honesty. Now, looking back, it was God showing me what I had endured to prep me for the next point, which was she comes up and she says, I need to go to AA. Okay. And we've had this discussion before. I've told her to go to AA. I wasn't going, but hey, it seemed like it would be great for her. So I don't know how to get to AA. When I was in AA, there was no app. There was little paper books. I haven't seen a paper book in 25 years. I don't know. I pick up the phone, and if this isn't God working through people in this program, it is nothing. God is everything, or God is nothing. And in my world, God is everything. I pick up the phone. I call my friend Butch, the supportive living house I lived in. His parents donated that house to the Oxford Group to be a supportive living house because their son Butch was there when I was there the first time in 1999. He did my intake into the house, oriented me, gave me the rules of the house, and took me to my first meeting. I called him. He was on his way home from a trap house. He'd been smoking crack and drinking, and he answered the phone from somebody that he knew from AA, got me the info on how to get on the chair app. I gave that to my wife, and she went to the Holiday Village meeting at 12:30 in Hamburg, and that was her first meeting. I was definitely leaving. I had given up. I was moving out. I was done. And over the course, I'll give you one more quick over the course. Her like seventh or eighth day, she was very like off, uncomfortable. She had a couple of good days. This was a bad day. I'm like, stay home. Like, listen, if this is really, if you're that bad, stay home. No, I have to go to work. She's got good work. Said, okay, do me a favor. If you have problems, call me every hour on the hour, and we will hour step this day from end to end. We'll get you through it. It'll be okay. So I wasn't really being super helpful at this point. I was still figuring out how to leave. Now I'm questioning my whole game plan because of God. And she comes home and I'm getting called. She shows me her phone. And now she's only been in AA like 5 days, 6 days. Someone from the program, and she had been on the phone like a maniac every night. She's dialing those numbers of people she doesn't know, talking to other alcoholics. I've never seen anything like it. You usually can't get an alcoholic to make one call, let alone to get them start calling those numbers like they were old college buddies and talking to people you don't know. And she did that. Every hour to 90 minutes, somebody from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous texted or called her that day. You could have given me a $1 billion budget. I couldn't put that together. I wasn't even going to AA yet. I started to go after that, where I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to go too. And it got me back in the program. Coming short on time. So this time around, I came in and I remember hearing a lot of people talk about when you come in the second time. My first time was easy. It felt like I didn't have to do any work. I was just here. All these old guys were just willing to take you out for coffee and give you rides and talk to you about how stupid your problems were and then give you actual tangible solutions to those problems. The second time, I started to panic a little bit because I thought maybe I know too much. Maybe this isn't going to work for me this time. You know, it's the second time around. So I called a friend that I met out here in the South Collins and I said, hey, I need to get into the steps. Can we do this? We do the steps. Looking for a sponsor, but I kind of had half-assed him, but didn't. And when I asked him, he said he was going through some stuff and he wasn't really in a position to take on another sponsee, that he had a few. He said, but I'm going to introduce you to a guy. He's like, if you and this guy get along, he's your guy. And he introduced me to Brian Berry. I don't know if any of you know him. Brian is an extraordinary human being. And he and I met and we talked and we became friends. And we've since gone through the steps, still going through them. He rebooted me the other day on some nonsense to go back and start another four step on some stuff that we clearly didn't get. He's into service like it's a sport because he believes services will keep you sober. I recently took on District 16 treatment chair. I don't even know what that is really, and I'm struggling to get it going, but I'm going to do it because I know that there are people that need help. And I needed help not too long ago, and somebody was there for me. So if I could tell anybody here anything, it seems like we got some people that are pretty solid. It's this program works If I get off my ass and I go do the work, if I pray every day, if I talk to my sponsor, if I reach out, I text probably 20 alcoholics every morning, like clockwork. They get me, I get them. It's really irrelevant, but at least 20 of us stay connected every single day. And sometimes it's a quick, hey. Sometimes it's, hey, do you have time to talk or have an interview? Of course, why not? It's 5 in the morning sometimes. But this time I'm doing the work. And unlike the first time around, the promises came true. Everything got good. I got everything in the promises. It all fell into place. This time around, the promises are kind of like twofold. This time, this program didn't save my life. It offered my 17-year-old daughter her life. It's offering my wife and I another chance at being married in a correct way. And I'd lie to you if I told you that was easy. We just had our first, I think I just had my first real adult man to woman, I'm in a relationship conversation. I think I just had that first conversation the other night. There was no emotion. There was no raised voices. We talked about deep issues. And it was never more than, for the first time in my life, I listened to understand so that I might better figure out how to put my life back together. And while I was doing that, and I was going to interrupt her one time because that's my MO, and I'm in my head and I'm like, shut the F up and just listen to her. And that's my sponsor tells me all the time. When you're in a conversation with your wife, shut up. Listen. And I did that. And the conversation, despite being some of the most sensitive topics that we have in our life, went incredibly well. That has nothing to do with me. In and of myself, drinking or not, I'm not capable of that conversation. I'm only capable of that when I pray, when I lean on God. I'm going to leave with this because I'm just kind of rambling here. But this, I heard this analogy the other day, and it really set home with me. And it's, how do we trust God, and then how do we rely on Him? Well, if I trust God, I go to a circus, and I watch a guy climb up a ladder, and he's on a high wire, and he's got a wheelbarrow. And I trust that God's going to get that guy across the cable on the wheelbarrow. He's going to get him over. That's what God will do. Now, if I rely on God, I climb my big ass up that thing, get in the platform, and I sit in the wheelbarrow. Now I'm relying on God to get me across. And if I can rely on God and I can truly take my hands off the wheel, I couldn't create a single thing in my life that's better than what He has planned for me. So for me, I really appreciate the fact that anybody wants to hear my story. I really appreciate the fact that I can have an opportunity to come talk to people. I do prison work. I talk to prisoners. My sponsor is a retired prison guard. I asked him, should I do this? Nope. So what? He's like, you have to go do this. The biggest worry of a prisoner getting out is what's next. They're looking at what they know, and they're looking at back to the streets, back to the neighborhood. I didn't go back to the streets. I didn't go back to my neighborhood. I chose a different path, and it was hard. And here I live at the beach, and I have a career. It's my second career, and I have a family. I'm proof that you can come from, what's that? What's that? Oh, sorry. I'm proof that you can do it different. I go to the rehabs because I was in a rehab. A lot of the guys that go to like Turning Point are a little older, so these kids don't really relate. I walk in there, start telling them stories about being every bit as bad or if not worse than they were. And then, oh, by the way, we don't do that. We do this, and we don't have to do that. So I really appreciate you guys having me here, man. I appreciate it a lot, and I hope you guys all have a great day. Thanks.